Hello, everybody. Good afternoon or good morning, I guess, depending on where you happen to be sitting right now. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be moderating today's webinar on answering your questions about consent. Obtaining consent and knowing when consent has been revoked are two of the most important components of maintaining an effective communication strategy in the credit and collection industry today. In this webinar, which is being sponsored by Solutions by Text, we have a panel of leading compliance executives who are here to answer questions about consent as it pertains to communicating with consumers. As courts continue to issue differing opinions interpreting the TCPA, staying on top of this shifting landscape has never been more important. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Solutions by Text. You get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. John Bedard is an attorney and nationally recognized authority on the FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA. He represents creditors, collectors, and attorneys, helping them stay in compliance with state and federal law. He also provides civil and regulatory defense litigation services throughout the country. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is Vice President of Legal and Compliance and Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. She serves on the board of directors for the Receivables Management Association and is an ACA International Certified Instructor. She also served as a small entity representative for the arbitration and debt collection rulemakings. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, can be found on Podbean and AccountsRecovery.net. Collection Advisor magazine named Kelly one of the 20 most powerful women in collections in 2018. John W. McGinnis is a partner at Manat, Phelps & Phillips. He represents clients in defending consumer class and individual actions across the country, including issues involving consumer protection, mortgage financial services, and data security and privacy. John handles litigations, regulatory proceedings, and examinations related to both state and federal consumer protection statutes such as the TCPA, FCRA, FDCPA, Song-Beverly Credit Card Act, and Truth in Lending Act. Working from both DC and Los Angeles, John regularly represents publicly traded companies and emerging businesses and industries that include financial services, retail, media, and technology, among numerous others. This event is being recorded, and recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. The format for today's webinar will be a little bit different than usual. This webinar is intended to be an opportunity for those of you listening to submit your questions to our panel about obtaining, maintaining, and revoking consent. Your questions are not only encouraged, but pretty much required to make sure we have a good event today. So to submit a question, please enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Finally, I just wanted to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen after today's webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation, especially sharing ideas for things you'd like to see covered in future webinars, is incredibly important, and I'd love to hear from each of you about what you'd like to see addressed in an upcoming webinar. So please take a minute and fill out the survey when that pops up. With that, before that, I've got one more thing to make sure nobody gets in any trouble. Let me read the following disclaimer. This conversation and presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area and should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, let's start our conversation today by talking a little bit about consent while we give everybody a chance to start submitting your questions. John, why don't you walk us through what consent is and how it applies to the conversation we're having today?
Sure. This is John McGinnis. As there are two Johns on this panel, but thanks, Mike. Well, the question is, why are we having a webinar for an hour to discuss consent. And the reason is really simple. It's that in order for a debt collector to communicate with the consumer by text message or call, they using what's called an automatic telephone dialing system or an ATDS, the debt collector needs to obtain consent of the person being texted. It's as simple as that. And without getting that consent, there are many risks, including, you know, potentially ruinous damages, equal to, you know, between $500 and $1,500 per violation. So the dangers of not having consent in order to communicate by text or by call with debt collectors, consumers is very high and very real. So text messaging has become an important topic and a frequently discussed topic by me, at least, over the last several months or year, as the debt collection industry tries to shift away from communicating with the consumers by telephone, and doing it in a way that's more cost efficient, that's more likely to get responses, that's more likely to actually be seen and opened, and that's by text messaging, as well as debt collectors having the ability to send many, many texts at the same time. It just increases the efficiencies for the debt collector. So, I think the first question or the first issue that needs to be addressed is that in order under the TCPA, debt collectors may not send informational text messages to consumers using an ATDS without obtaining their prior express consent. So if you look at that in three different parts, the first question some may have is, well, what's an informational text message and how does that differ from other sorts of text messages? Well, informational text messages in the context of debt collection pertain to customers' accounts, including, for example, billing or collections purposes. Other informational text messages will include accounts billing alerts, account updates, payment reminders, and payment confirmations or acknowledgments, those sorts of things, updates to terms and conditions of the debt collector. Those are informational text messages that pertain to the debt that is at issue. And they're distinguished from advertising or promotional text messages, which are sent with the purpose of increasing sales or promoting products or services about someone's business. And for those sort of text messages, dealing with advertising or marketing text messages, there's an elevated level of consent that's required before sending text messages or making calls to those folks. And we can have a whole nother webinar just on what is what's required for prior express written consent. One question I frequently get, and then I'll ask for, you know, input from Kelly and John on this, is, you know, is consent required to send a text if a text message is not sent using an ATDS? And the short answer to that question is no, it's consent isn't required because the statutory definition requires the use of an ATDS. But the question then becomes, well, what is an ATDS? And that's a much more complicated question. It's also a moving target, and it's also the answer is different depending upon where you are in the country. If you're in the Ninth Circuit, for example, which are those in along the West Coast, there's the definition of what constitutes an ATDS is very, very, very broad. If you're somewhere else, for example, in DC, in most other jurisdictions, the definition of what is an ATDS is a lot narrower, and therefore presumably less chance that you're going to be held liable for sending a text when using some sort of technology to assist with that. We can go into further discussion on that, but let me step aside for a second to see if John and or Kelly have anything to add, at least to that primer on TCPA consent.
John, this is John Bedard, and thank you for giving us all that sort of primer to kick off today's seminar. I agree with everything you've just said. I tell clients put it this way, I subscribe to the Seventh Circuit and the 11th Circuit's interpretation of the statute, which is that we must have random or sequential number generators in our machines in order for them to be ATDSs. And so when I get that very same question that you get from clients, which is, you know, what is an ATDS and do I have one? The answer is almost always no, you don't have one. And that's our position, because there is nobody, at least in the ARM space that I know of, that in the last 20 years or 30 years has used a machine in the way that the statute originally contemplated it, which is to literally be randomly dialing random telephone numbers that the machine generates. And so I think if the marketplace and the industry stays the course, I think more and more courts around the country are going to read the statute properly, and they are not going to read out of the statute the very deliberate words that Congress placed into the definition of automatic telephone dialing system, like we saw in the Ninth Circuit. And so that's what we've been telling clients when that issue comes up, at least in our office.
Yeah, and this is Kelly. I'd just like to add, because John and John laid everything out there perfectly, that, you know, there's a lot of different types of consent, right? And we've been talking about consent under the TCPA, which deals with, you know, using an ATDS to, call someone on their cell phone. It also involves, pre-recorded messages that you are leaving on landlines. And it involves, you know, when you are sending a text message to a consumer, because a text is a call. If you're talking about other types of communications, you know, like letters, you don't need consent to send a consumer a letter. Emails, you don't need consent to send a consumer a debt collection email. The only caveat to that is if you are using an email to send the initial demand, not as your first communication, then you would need to have consent to send the written initial demand within 5 days of your initial communication. That's consent that would be required under a combination of the FDCPA and the eSign Act. But if you are sending your initial demand as your first communication with a consumer, you can send that by email without having consent. There's no requirement in the law for consent there. Social media, I was making a list of like, okay, well, how are all the ways that you might be reaching out to a consumer where you may or may not need consent? Social media, you probably don't need consent for social media. I haven't really thought through that all the way. You would have FDCPA concerns, because certainly, you know, the CFPB in their debt collection rulemaking talked about how private chat is one thing because it's private, but certainly, you know, any communication with someone on social media, without their agreement would be a third party disclosure, right? If you're posting on somebody's Facebook page, that would be a problem. The reason why I mentioned social media is we had someone reach out to us on Twitter and say, hey, how do I stop an upcoming payment? And so this was a real first time for us where we were like, consumers reached out to us voluntarily on Twitter, posting to the world that she wants to know how to cancel her upcoming payment. And so we responded because we knew she wanted to know. And so we kind of felt like, well, her reaching out in this medium to us is consent for us to respond to her. Hey, give us a call here or email here and you can get that answer right away. You know, just a little bit about some other types of consent that are out there. I think generally a lot of consumers think that they should have the right to determine how they're going to communicate with debt collectors. And so, you know, they might feel like they have the right to consent when in reality, there's nothing in the law that requires consent. And I think that's probably just the TCPA consent that's required for auto-dialed calls and texts kind of bleeding into other forms of communication.
Okay. Kelly, this is Bedard.
Excellent start. Go ahead, John.
The only, you know, one of the things that I will add one more thing to your email consent. We ask clients to be sensitive to email addresses that they have reason to believe may be given to a consumer by their employer. And so to the extent a client wants to communicate with a consumer using an email address that appears to be an email address assigned by an employer, we'll ask clients to be especially sensitive to those email addresses. I won't go so far as to say you must get consent to communicate at that email address too. However, because the statute says nothing about that, but the Bureau has some very strong opinions about debt collectors who communicate with consumers by email using an email address that has been provided by a consumer's employer. And so that's one thing that we ask clients to be especially sensitive to when it comes to sending emails. I won't go so far as to say consent, but it is something that I think is worthy of some sensitivity.
For sure. And I think I should add one other point. The state of New York 100% requires consent for a debt collector before they can email. So let me put that out there too, because there's a hurdle in the state of New York. And, you know, the Bureau is sensitive both with text and emails about how did you get this number or this email? And, you know, are you going to, from a third party perspective, because you don't know if the cell phone number is a work issued number. You don't know sometimes if the email is a work issued number. And so, you know, in their debt collection proposal, they suggest some safe harbor, practices to ensure that when you're reaching out, you are taking those things into consideration when you're designing your practices. And we can talk about that as we keep going.
And one other thing I was going to add, this is McGinnis, don't forget too, and you mentioned one of these laws, Kelly, and I was going to chime in on this before you spoke, is don't forget the state laws, the analogous state laws that, have certain, anti-solicitation laws or some UDAP, they all have UDAP laws, but cases in which, UDAP is used. Where emailing from debt collectors is involved, or anti-spam laws, all those state laws need to be considered as well. And that's frequently a recommendation and a direction that I give to my clients too, when they want to start any sort of communication campaign, whether it be by email or text or otherwise.
Okay, excellent. Well, we do have a couple of questions that have come in already, so we'll start with those. And if anybody else has questions for John Bedard, John McGinnis, or Kelly, submit them now, and we'll get to them as the discussion keeps going. The first question is, when obtaining verbal recorded consent with a consumer, do you also need to include language that tells them how they can revoke consent?
Well, let me ask this. Answer it this way. You don't, in order for a debt collector to send informational text messages or to a consumer, they don't need a verbal consent. Okay. I just want to make sure that's clear. Okay. Prior express consent to send informational text message or for informational purposes, the consent can be obtained simply by the consumer voluntarily providing his or her phone number to the creditor, absent instruction to the contrary. So, for example, if a consumer fills out a credit card or loan application and they include their phone number in there, consent is going to be inferred from there that they can be contacted about that particular loan at that particular number for informational purposes only. To the extent that that consent is being provided for information, for advertising and marketing purposes, then there has to be, it's not verbal consent, but it's prior express written consent is required for that. So a customer can provide verbal consent to receiving informational text messages, but it's not necessary. So that's, I just want to make sure that that's, that is clear. In terms of revocation, and this is an important issue because, you know, in my practice, I feel that this is the area where the most danger resides for my clients, because people are so concerned about the upfront consent, but they don't pay enough attention to the revocation and having proper procedures in place for when someone revokes consent. There's no requirement that that when somebody provides their phone number as part of the credit application, which is inferred consent to receive informational text messages, that there also be some sort of notice about revocation. That's not required. And that makes sense because their consent is being inferred. So it's not a specific affirmative, consent that's being sought and provided. However, when you're texting, it's always wise to include in the text message something to the effect that, to the extent that you no longer want to receive these text messages, then text stop or some sort of command like that. But there's no requirement for an upfront notice about revocation.
This is Bedard. It is worth noting, however, and that's correct. I agree with you, John. It is worth noting, however, the FCC's attitude towards revocation. And the FCC has publicly declared that they believe consumers should be able to revoke their consent in any reasonable manner using any reasonable means. And then the question becomes, well, what does that mean? And so I think this question goes to this notion about what is the reasonableness of somebody's revocation, and the FCC has commented on that and said, look, if you, sender of a message, if you give consumers a method of opting out, then when it comes time to measure the reasonableness of that consumer's revocation behavior, we're going to consider whether or not you have given the consumer adequate instructions on how you would like for them to revoke. And so, although there is no absolute requirement to provide consumers instructions on how they can revoke, when it comes time to determine the reasonableness of the consumer's behavior when they revoke, I think that the FCC would like for the sender's behavior to be considered in terms of whether or not they've given consumers adequate notice of a preferred way of revocation. Is that fair,
John? Yeah, that is, and that's an excellent point. And truth of the matter is, what is reasonable? If you're conservative, which my clients tend to be, in order to mitigate their TCPA liability in particular, or enforcement, any sort of enforcement actions by the regulator, you're receptive to all different sorts of methods of revocation, whether it be verbal, whether it be by email, whether it be by text. And it's not just texting stop, it's other words that are utilized. There's no one way to do it. If you provide it in your terms and conditions what the proper method is or what you consider to be reasonable, that is very, very compelling. But if someone doesn't abide by those instructions in someone's terms and conditions, but does it in another way that's considered, you know, that's by voice or by email, then that too can still be considered reasonable, and to be conservative, that those, you know, those requests should be honored and honored very quickly.
Yeah.
The other thing I would add to my two esteemed John's information here is outside of the TCPA, because the question's really, you know, about obtaining recorded consent with a consumer. There might be other times when you're recording a consumer's consent, right? So if you're recording a consent that, you know, for example, e-sign consent, right? If you're doing a combination of, you know, trying to set up post-dated check payments with a consumer, and the Electronic Funds Transfer Act applies, and so you're trying to, you know, capture that consumer's written consent electronically, because you're not going to send them something in the mail and expect them to sign it and return it, but instead you're on a recorded line, you're trying to capture their written consent for the post-dated, you know, payments, and you're going to use the eSign Act to make sure that, you know, you can capture that written consent that way. eSign does require that you provide certain notices to the consumer before you obtain their consent. And one of those things includes how they can opt out of getting electronic disclosures and instead, you know, basically revoking their consent to receive electronic disclosures. So that's something that you have to kind of think about. It's a very good question, because you need to think about your answer for each type of consent that you are obtaining on that recorded line. Because if it is a consent that needs e-sign consent, then, you know, if you're, whatever your e-sign flow is, maybe you're providing those notices to the consumer, you know, electronically first. However you're doing it, you're going to want to think through, okay, well, if this is the consent, how am I going to tell them about revocation? And I think too, it also comes down to consumers expect that their consent is going to be asked for and obtained, and that they're going to be able to revoke. So, you know, giving them options and multiple ways to provide that information to you only helps your company better serve those consumers. And ultimately, you know, if they like how you are treating them, they're more likely to pay you.
Kelly, this is Bedard. It's also worth noting that if the CFPB has its way, all electronic communications from a debt collector to a consumer will contain an opt-out notice that instructs consumers on how to opt out of those electronic communications. And to the extent that's akin to the revocation that the questioner is posing to us here, then that's also something to keep in mind, because that's on the horizon.
Yep, that's a good point.
All right, I just want to jump in quick and pause the discussion briefly. I'd like to say a few words about the sponsor for today's webinar, Solutions by Text. Solutions by Text is a division of Marketing Response Solutions, LLC, a privately held corporation whose primary focus is delivering critical information in an SMS format worldwide. Solutions by Text has developed a proprietary software designed to adhere to regulations within the mobile phone industry. Solutions by Text strives to develop a scalable solution with flexibility to meet industry changes in demand, maintain a functional user interface with various user access options, build products delivering a clear, consistent value, and construct a suite of services matching the demands of the consumer. For more than 25 years, Solutions by Text has partnered with a variety of organizations in multiple industries to design and implement a diverse SMS solution. Solutions by Text customizes a suite of services to meet client requirements and maintain ease of use. For more information, please visit www.solutionsbytext.com. Thanks again to Solutions by Text for sponsoring today's webinar. Let's pick up with our questions. We've got a bunch more that have come in. A question for John Bedard. Okay, so if we don't have an ATDS, then we do not need consent at all unless we are leaving pre-recorded messages. Yes.
Yes, only so long as you're willing to live with the answer that the court gives you about whether or not the machine you're using is an ATDS at the time you are having to defend whether or not you're calling cell phones without consent with or without an ATDS. That's a long question to a short answer there, but if you're not using an ATDS and you are not using a pre-recorded voice or an artificial voice, well then yes, technically the TCP, this portion of the TCPA is not going to apply to you. The question is whether or not you're willing to take the risk on making those calls in light of the uncertainty in the jurisprudence about whether or not the machine you're using is actually an ATDS. Some of the the judges on the highest rungs of our judicial system can't agree on what an ATDS is when they all read the same words, and so therefore that makes it especially risky to move forward without consent. But if you are comfortable that the machine you're using is not an automatic telephone dialing system, well then yeah, that portion of the statute that requires consent, I think is not going to apply to those phone calls.
And just to provide a little bit more color on this, John, and I agree with you 100% on that. Just so that if you're in California, for example, which is in the Ninth Circuit, the case that is the bane of many of our clients' existences is referred to as Marks. And in that case, the court held that an ATDS includes devices that store telephone numbers to be called, whether or not the device has the ability to generate numbers randomly or sequentially. And if you think about that, our iPhones fall into that category, right? That's a device that stores telephone numbers to be called. So that'll just tell you how unbelievably broad the Marks definition of an ATDS is. So if you're in that Ninth Circuit in California and Washington and Oregon, Nevada, you really have to be careful with to the extent that any technology is being utilized that stores telephone numbers. And in fact, I mean, we say jokingly sometimes that the only safe thing to do really is have a rotary phone. When you're in the Ninth Circuit, at the risk that, you know, Marks is going to apply and the court's going to find that you have an ATDS and now you're subject to potentially ruinous damages.
Okay. Let's move on. We got a lot more questions coming in here. A hypothetical scenario, a debt collector sends a text that provides a method to unsubscribe from text messaging. If the consumer responds as requested, there's no question that the consumer has effectively said, don't text me. But what if the consumer doesn't follow the specified procedure? Are courts and the CFPB likely to restrict the consumer to the prescribed method of revocation, or are they likely to interpret revocation of consent broadly, such as the cease and desist cases where sending a letter back saying future letters will be returned unopened, thus saying that the consumers can revoke consent in some way, some other way, sometimes a way that is not readily identifiable as such. Everybody got that?
I think so. This is Bedard. Let me try and take a shot at it, and then John and Kelly will fix everything I'm about to say when I'm finished. And so what we have not yet begun to talk about on this call is consent for what? What is it? I mean, we're talking consent in this nebulous way, you know, consent to receive a text message, consent to communicate at all, consent to use a certain channel. What I have seen most successfully is text messaging channels used by debt collectors in which the consumer themselves has to opt into that communication channel. And when they opt into that communication channel, they are also opting into certain what I'll call ground rules in terms of how that channel is going to be utilized. And so if the consumer opts into this platform and the rules of the platform or the instructions or the ground rules through by which we're going to use this communication channel indicates to the consumer that in order to stop the behavior, you have to use the word stop and not use an entire paragraph of prose to say, you know, good morning, it is my desire for you to not send me communications by text message anymore. No, you know, stop is the only word you need to use in order to opt yourself out of this text messaging platform. And I think that the arguments are very strong on why, you know, 47 words that a consumer uses to demonstrate their desire not to receive text messages is not going to suffice when they could have, should have, and agreed to use the word stop when they opted into the text message platform. That's a long answer to this hypothetical, but I think the long and short of it is that when consumers opt into these platforms, they're going to be opting into certain ground rules, and that's going to include sort of how it is that we're going to revoke or stop these communications as well. Okay, Kelly and John, fix everything I just said.
Well, I'm not going to fix it because I think everything you say is right. And so I would just add the following. We thought a lot about this when we were looking at the California Consumer Privacy Act and how we were going to interpret a please delete all my information request under the FDCPA and the TCPA. Because if someone says to you, I want you to delete all my information, I think they're probably saying they don't want you to have their phone number because they don't want you to make calls. So is that a cease and desist? Does that also mean they're revoking their consent? And we decided that we were just going to tell consumers, like, if you want us to stop contacting you, you know, please reach out to us here because we are only interpreting your request to delete information as a request to delete information. So, you know, we added a sentence so that we would kind of cover ourselves there. But at the same time, you know, because you don't want to encourage people to shut down the ways in which you can communicate with them, you know, particularly as you're trying to reach out to them and figure out what channel is the best way to do so. So it's important to think about, you know, maybe there's a way that you can make clear responding stop will stop text messages.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. And John, what John and Kelly have said is consistent with what my recommendation is. And so while it's not legally required, opt-ins for debt collection, texting are usually my recommendation to clients, and with consent language and revocation language drafted, you know, broadly but clearly, and include, you know, the examples of the type of messages, for example, a consumer can expect to receive, and the types of revocations that you know, the company would consider, you know, reasonable. So it really is about disclosures. You know, to the extent that you can get a customer to opt in rather than inferring consent, that's just going to make your consent defense that much more compelling. To the extent there's litigation in this space, and it's important to remember that consent is a defense, it's an affirmative defense to a TCPA claim, meaning that the burden would be on us, the debt collectors, to prove consent. So having that sort of clear language in policies and procedures that are part of an opt-in process, that would make me feel pretty good as a defense side litigator, in terms of proving that, hey, look, we got consent, and therefore you don't have, you know, a TCPA claim. And in fact, John, too, the opt-ins, we've talked a lot about the TCPA and the FDCPA, but the, you know, opt-in, an affirmative opt-in also, you know, to receive texts sort of helps with complying with the industry guidelines too, like the CTIA, which, you know, while not, you know, legally binding, are influential at least in terms of sure. what is acceptable and what's not in the industry. So.
All right, let's move on to our next question. Maybe Kelly, you can take a crack at this one. When speaking to which district you are operating in, is this based on where you operate your business or where the consumer with whom you are speaking resides?
That is an excellent question. So it would be where the consumer is going to sue you that you're speaking with. So it's most usually where the consumer resides. Every once in a while, they might sue you in your district, but the court where the consumer sues you is going to apply the law of that district. So if the consumer is a California consumer, they sue you in California because you do business in California, even though you're a Kansas company and you reach out to California consumers by phone, by email, by text, by however you're sued in California, they're going to apply the Ninth Circuit very broad Marks definition where my cell phone is basically an ATDS. So unfortunately, it's where the consumer sues you and you can't necessarily crystal ball that. And that's one of the problems that collection agencies have across the US is trying to develop one policy, one procedure to handle these things when you have moving law targets in the different districts. So it can be really complicated. But that is the answer.
And that's a good answer, Kelly. But this is a good and an interesting question because it's sometimes, you know, where folks like John and I spend a lot of our time on issues like this, because if you're a plaintiff and a plaintiff lawyer, you want to try to force your way somehow into a court in the Ninth Circuit, into California. So the interesting cases are when you have a plaintiff who's a New York resident and a company that's headquartered in Florida, that's where it has its principal place of business, and it really doesn't do much business in California, but you're sued in California, you know, to try to, you know, force a, you know, square peg into a round hole. Those are the cases where, you know, that where there's a lot of litigation to try to get the case out of the Ninth Circuit into a circuit that has, you know, laws that are more favorable to the defendants in those cases.
Okay. Let's move on. John Bedard, here's a question for you. Does consent provided to a creditor pass to a subsequent owner and or debt collector?
Okay. So the FCC has spoken on this issue. And when the consent is given to a creditor, for example, in a credit application, then the agent that creditor hires to act on its behalf, like, for example, a debt collector, is also deemed by to have consent to call. Yes. And so I want to be careful about using words like consent passes or transfers and all that, but because the agent is acting in the stead of the creditor under those circumstances, the FCC believes that, yes, that agent is acting on the consent that the consumer gave the creditor. It gets a little bit more complicated when we're talking about purchase debt and two or three purchases down the life cycle of an account. But I think that's a direct way of answering this question right here.
Okay. Let's move on. Here's a question that I think three lawyers are going to love. Can't reasonable mean different things to different people? What's reasonable to you may not be reasonable to me.
This
and correct.
To law school. Yeah. There's like very many days where you talk about who is the reasonable person and who is an eggshell person, someone who is, you know, sensitive like Humpty Dumpty might fall off the wall and break. So, yeah, at least for collections, we know that we're dealing with the least sophisticated consumer. So when you're thinking about how you are, you know, shaping your collection communications, you can look at it from that perspective, the perspective of the least sophisticated consumer. And, you know, there's all that language out there that's like, the least sophisticated consumer is not like, you know, a totally naive, innocent person that's never been involved in credit transactions. I mean, nobody really knows who these people are. You can just design your own internal practices in a way that seems logical and that lets people know, in the event that you have to defend them, that you have a documented practice for making sure and evaluating your communications, including how you're communicating about consent and revocation and stuff, from that angle of, you know, the least sophisticated consumer.
Right, and that exact, it's that exact reason, meaning like the ambiguity or the of the term reasonableness, or the fact that it is subjective, is the very reason why we, you know, often recommend defining reasonableness in the company's terms and conditions or somewhere on the website, to provide the debtor some idea of what it is that you consider reasonable, to at least establish some sort of standard. Although, you know, it's unlikely that a court will limit reasonableness to what it is that one provides on their website or defines reasonableness to include. It should be to the extent that, you know, someone calls and says, look, I'm revoking my consent to receive text messaging or emails or something. Even if that's not what's explained in the terms and conditions as being considered reasonable, and it would be likely held to be reasonable under the law. So, but it's that exact reason why we recommend, hey, look, write it down, put it in writing, have it on the website. To the extent that you require an opt-in, agreeing to those terms, then the better consent, language we have, and the better defense we have, to the extent something goes sideways.
Yeah, so
speaking of writing things down, sorry, go ahead, Kelly. Go ahead.
I was going to say, someone asked another interesting question here relating to domain names and best practices. If your email address is, accountsrecovery.net, it seems obvious that you must be a debt collection company. And, does that mean we should not email consumers? And I think it's something that's a good thing that you are thinking about. But when the CFPB was thinking about emailing, at no point did they look at what your domain name is, because it's better for you to have a domain name that matches your company, because consumers, when they look at emails, they're going to want to check you out, right? They're going to want to know that you are not a spammer. So they're going to want to have the opportunity to go look at and confirm that you are registered with the BBB and that you have a good grade, and that you are a legitimate company that has a CFPB complaint portal or is RMAI certified, whatever it is. What the CFPB looked at from a third party disclosure violation when it came to best practices for email and text message was, number one, using an email or a phone number that the consumer used to contact you. Number two, using an email or a phone number that the consumer used with a prior creditor or a prior debt collector that was not a work email, where the consumer didn't unsubscribe to those communications but recently communicated with that creditor or prior debt collector from that email address or from that phone number. Sending a warm transfer letter. Now, they didn't use the term warm transfer letter. They said something like, sending a notice where you tell the consumer, hey, we're creditor X, we're sending this to debt collection. You know, here's the debt collection company we're sending it to. They're going to reach out to you at this email address, this phone number. If you don't want email or text messages at these numbers, please opt out in the next 30 days. If they don't opt out, then you would be permitted to use those emails. And those practices would be a bona fide error defense around a third-party disclosure claim. They also want to make sure that you're monitoring your communications so that you know that the consumer has the unsubscribe, as John mentioned earlier. There's another question here I wanted to throw out for our esteemed panelists around verbally asking for consent to text and email for a consumer. As long as they have to opt in via the text and email we send. This might relate a little bit to eSign. So again, you don't need consent to email unless your first communication with them did not contain the validation notice in the body of an email. So if your first communication was by phone and then you were gonna send the initial demand letter via email, and you wanted to, over the phone, get that consumer's consent to, say, text them the initial demand or email them the initial demand, you could absolutely get their consent over the phone to do so. You just have to follow the steps of eSign. And one of the steps of eSign is making sure that you know that consumer can receive the message in the medium in which you're communicating, so like a text message or an email. So that's why a lot of your banks will send you, if you're opting into email, they'll send you a code at your email that you then have to put back into the website. You could do that same code to the cell phone or email that the consumer reads back to you over the phone. Then you know that they can receive email or text message, and then you've met, you know, your requirements of eSign if that's how you're sending it. What do the Johns think?
You know, Kelly, this is Bernard. I refer to that as eSign's technology handshake. You know, the premise of eSign is that if somebody who's required to provide a consumer some disclosures that have to be in writing, well, then the person obligated to provide those disclosures may substitute an electronic record for that writing that they would otherwise provide, but only so long as that sender first engages in what I like to refer to as the technology handshake. I have to provide the consumer some information about the technology they need and how I'm going to send it and the technology I'm going to use to send it, and then they're going to handshake back and say, okay, yes, I received it in some way. That, you know, they're going to demonstrate their ability to receive what it is that you send them. And so so long as we go through that eSign technology handshake, then we can now begin to substitute electronic records for these writings that many statutes around the country require.
One other thing I'd like to add is the importance of retaining records of both consent and revocation. So looking past what is considered reasonable revocation and do we have prior express written consent or prior express consent for that matter, is making sure that everyone retains records of consent at least for 4 years, which is the statute of limitation for TCPA, 4 years from the date in which the text message was sent. And it's critical to do that for my debt collector clients, because again, consent is my burden. And so I need evidence that consent was provided in order to defeat plaintiff's claim if plaintiff is able to meet all the other requirements of the TCPA. So it's really important to not just delete your information and to hold on to it for at least 4 years. I usually recommend, a period of time a little longer than 4 years, depending upon the situation for the clients. But I know that's not apropos of anything or responsive to anything we were just discussing, but I know we're coming to an end, but it's an important point.
You know, along that line, someone did say, well, what happens if somebody, revokes consent with the creditor and then the creditor passes you that same number, you know, would we be in violation? And I think the answer would be yes, because the person had already revoked their consent for that number. So you definitely want to work that out in your contract with the creditor, so that if they, they're going to own up to their own liability there if there's a flaw in their practices. Passing, I've heard John Bedard talk about this actually a bunch before, about the capacity of the systems of information that the collection agencies and the creditors have to be able to both capture the consent and capture the revocation for each and every form of communication that is used, for each and every phone number that you have in your system, is really critical in the day and age that we live in, with the TCPA and the liability that we have there, and also just with the consumer's own, you know, belief that they should have the ability to, you know, say, hey, don't contact me in this medium anymore, and for you to, you know, take that in, process it, and make sure that you're not.
Okay, excellent. Well, we've just about reached our limit on time here, but before we wrap up, I'd like to give each of the panelists a chance to summarize their thoughts, share any other takeaways they want people to walk away from that they maybe didn't get a chance to address today, just because they didn't get a question on it or the conversation didn't head that way, but still feel as important within the context of the conversation, or you know, any other concluding remarks if they have anything they'd like to share. So we'll go around the panel and do that. John McGinnis, would you like to go first, please?
Sure. Just, you know, this is a follow-up point to one that was just, that we were just discussing in terms of managing your revocations and your consents and your opt-ins, and it's critical that happens. Well, what's the best way to do that? I mean, to the extent it's possible financially and all, is you know, using a reliable vendor, you know, hiring a, you know, text messaging platform provider who can easily you know, collect and compile consent and then the revocations of consents, and then notifying you in a timely manner. You know, if it's feasible, while it's not infallible, it's usually a pretty good process to avoid your TCPA liability. We certainly have cases in which, you know, the vendor made a mistake and our clients were sued, but we also make sure we have very good indemnification language in the contracts with the vendors. You should consider TCPA insurance too, which you can purchase to try to help offset your costs. But there are certain things you can do to try to minimize your risks and your exposure, and perhaps using a, you know, a vendor, you know, a reputable text messaging vendor is one of the ways I recommend for my clients in trying to do that. So.
Excellent. Thanks, John. John Bedard.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate you having us here today. For debt collectors who are considering creating consent workflow, I suggest two things, Mike. First, make sure you understand what you're seeking consent for. You're seeking consent for the channel, and you're seeking consent for third parties, third party disclosure, right? You're going to protect yourself against both of those things. Work that into your consent. The second thing is revocation. I tell clients revocation is just as important as consent. Make sure you have a mechanism and a workflow for capturing revocation. Make sure you are giving consumers instructions on how they can revoke and how they can opt out. Those are my parting words today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kelly?
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Johns. I would just add to John Bedard and to this person who asked this question in the chat box. You know, John Bedard is and John McGinnis are right. There's no reason why you shouldn't, even if you don't need consent, right, for email, there's no reason why you shouldn't work it in to your workflow with consumers. So, you know, someone asked, if a creditor has a consent clause in their service agreement, can that be used to justify electronic communication? Absolutely. You know, if a consumer is signing up for an online product and it's made clear to them that we're going to communicate with you via email, and if you don't pay, our debt collection company is going to communicate with you via email and communicate with you via text message and communicate with you via whatever, WhatsApp, you know, whatever methods, outlining that from the outset of the agreement makes it much easier down the road. So thanks so much for having us.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Kelly, John Bedard, John McGinnis. Really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights with us and give us some answers. We really didn't have a ton of time to think about. So being able to sort of think on the fly and provide some really insightful and comprehensive answers should not go unnoted and unthanked. So I really appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks again to Solutions by Text for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.solutionsbytext.com to learn more. Thanks everybody who participated. A final reminder to take a minute and fill out the feedback survey and share any ideas, issues, concerns, anything you want to see that addressed maybe in an upcoming webinar. Really would appreciate that. A recording of this event will be made available on accountsrecovery.net's webinar recordings page in the next day or so. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of their day. Really appreciate it. Panel, awesome job. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Great job.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, everybody.